Today's session is entitled Neutrality and Impartiality. Our trainer today is Alan Pence, and I'll pass it over to Alan now to introduce herself and to begin training today's training session. Thanks, Alan.
Well, thank you, Beth. Beth just said that if you want to get a copy of this tape, you can do so by requesting, but I'm just going to make a little caveat. Beth, that tape goes well. This is the first time I'm actually going to be talking on this, and if it kind of doesn't go well, then the tape is going to get somehow lost and burnt and be unavailable to everyone, so we'll see what happens here. The reason that we decided to do this topic right now is that we've just completed a whole round. I work for Practice, and Practice provides the TA to visitation centers that are funded by OVW, and in particular, we've been working with four, what everybody kind of knows as the demonstration sites. So Chicago, California, Michigan, and Kent, Washington, all applied for money like everyone else on the phone, only they also applied to be a demonstration site, which meant that OVW spent particular time with those centers and trying out new ideas and talking about ideas and trying to figure things out. And so over the last several years, those four centers have gotten together a lot and worked together a lot in trying to test out new ideas. And one of the things that came out right away when the centers started to go and look at what each other was doing, and for many of you on the phone, you've come to some of these TA events, some of the conferences and roundtables and things like that, and it gives people a chance to start talking to each other about what they're doing. And one of the things that we found with visitation centers is there was a shockingly amount of commonality amongst all the visitation centers in how they went about doing a lot of their business. And the reason for that, the reason so many centers did things in a similar way, was because of the work of the Supervised Visitation Center Network, SVN, which is actually an international network of supervised visitation centers, most of those centers being located in the U.S. and Canada, but some centers from other countries also participating. And that organization, really on a shoestring budget, has pulled together a national conference for the last few years, and they've set guidelines and standards for visitation centers to use, really trying to emphasize the need for visitation centers to really have some very, very strict standards to make sure that children that are using those centers are safe. And that is really the focus of SVN, is to make sure that staff have the ability to keep kids safe, the capacity to keep kids safe, and that organizations share a lot of information and knowledge together to figure out how to do that as visitation centers. So when OVW came up with a pot of money to fund visitation centers that were specifically charged with the responsibility of figuring out what would a visitation center look like if it was focusing on cases of domestic violence, stalking, child abuse related to domestic violence and stalking, and sexual abuse related to domestic violence and stalking. What would those visitation centers look like? Would they be any different than visitation centers opened across the country now? What were the special needs of adult victims that would be brought into the supervised visitation center world and thought about perhaps differently or in addition to the safety needs of children? And when OVW came up with this money, and then about 60 visitation centers were funded across the country, those centers started meeting, started talking to each other, going and seeing what each other was doing. And this issue of neutrality came up quite a bit. It was raised a lot in terms of what are we saying when we say that as visitation centers we're neutral? What are we neutral about and who are we neutral about? Now, the Supervised Visitation Center Network's guidelines are really guidelines to articulate what visitation centers who are really embedded very much in the protection of children in oftentimes child abuse cases, but also people that use centers across the country are also victims of domestic violence. But the emphasis in SVN literature and language and guidelines has been on how do you put kids first when there's a conflict between the parents, how do you make sure the kids are safe and how do you put their safety needs first? Well, along comes OVW with money that says, wait a minute, we want to put the needs of all victims as equal. So adult victims and child victims would have, the charge would be to protect both of them equally. Well, that threw a little clinker in what everybody had been saying, because the kind of standard languages, we try to remain neutral in the conflict between the parents, and we don't try to get into what their conflict is or their divorce proceedings or their custody battles. We try to make a space so that 2 hours every week or however much the visitation time is, that those children can come and have access to a parent without any kind of violence or harm coming to the children. OVW money in visitation centers had to add to that and no abuse or harm coming to the adult victim. So that meant that brought into question this notion of remaining neutral in a conflict between the parents. So a whole bunch of discussions started to happen, and all sorts of stuff came out, including a lot of arguing and fighting, and, oh, my God, what are we going to do? Because neutrality was such a sacred concept in the supervised visitation center world. So when that started to get challenged, why are we using the neutral word, we started to actually ask the question, how does that play out in practice? When we say we're being neutral in the conflict between the parents, what does that actually mean? Is there any harm to say that? I mean, maybe we don't even have to question it because nothing bad comes of saying that. Well, as people started to really examine, how does it impact us as visitation centers to take that stand, a lot of things started to come out that did start to question whether or not that statement, we're neutral in the conflict between the parents, doesn't in fact work to a batterer's advantage. So I want to give a couple of examples of how people started talking about that, but I first want to kind of back up here and maybe tell a little story here about a case that really brought some of this to the forefront. But before I do that, I'm going to even back up a little further and talk about a case that I watched one day when I was watching a visitation center operating, and this man was visiting his daughter, and this guy had sexually abused this girl between the time that she was 8 and about almost 11 years old. And he was arrested, and he was not convicted. He pled to another crime and agreed in conjunction with that plea to another crime of selling drugs that he would go into a treatment program for sex offenders. So the case of him sexually abusing his daughter was dropped in exchange for a guilty plea and an agreement to go into a sex offenders program. So he went into the sex offenders program. He did about 30 days in jail for the drug crime. He came out, and after about 4 or 5 months, he wanted to see his daughter and asked for a visitation. Supervised visitation was set up for him, and his daughter was very, very reluctant to see him. She agreed to see him, but when it came time for the visit, she was really, really afraid to see him. She wasn't sure if she wanted to. She thought she might go in and see him for 5 minutes, and then when it came time to see him, she didn't really want to. So she was really ambivalent about whether she wanted to see her father at all, and she definitely was afraid of him. So she wanted to have two monitors in the room. She kept trying to negotiate the conditions under which she would see him. As I was watching this whole thing unfold, she eventually did, when I was there, she did go in and visit her father. And it was a very, very short visit, about 10 minutes. And afterwards, she was pretty shook up, but she said that she's glad she did it, that she felt that she was, you know, brave and that she overcame her fear and things like that. And when it was all over, and the girl had gone home and the father was gone, I was asking the staff if they considered themselves and how they handled this and how they talked to him and how they talked to her as neutral in the conflict between this girl and this father. And if they thought they would describe what was going on between this girl and her father as a conflict. And they all said, no, it's abuse. What he did to her was abusive. That's not conflict. And they also said they're not neutral. They're on the side of the child. And I would say, well, what does it mean to be on the side of the child in this case, that we're there to absolutely protect her? And if she would have ultimately said she didn't want to see him, even if he was insisting, we would have taken her side, if this and if that. And they started talking about what it meant to be on her side. To me, that was kind of a little light bulb going off about what is it, when we're saying that we're neutral, what are we being neutral about? And so then when it comes to adult victims, we have to ask the same question. Are we neutral in the conflict between a man who's battered his wife? Now she's using the visitation center. She may be the non-custodial parent, too. But she's there visiting because of however they ended up separating, however they ended up her leaving him or him leaving her or whatever. There's been supervised visitations ordered. For some of those battered women, they don't have custody of their kids anymore. If in Minnesota, for example, we have 12 factors that you can, that a judge must consider when awarding custody, one of them being domestic violence. But if the woman is battling with alcoholism or depression and mental illness or any of the kind of things that oftentimes battered women are struggling with after a separation, they oftentimes will lose custody of their kids to their abuser because the court has determined that they are not as able as him to care for the children, not as stable, not as economically able, not as emotionally able. And so many battered women lose custody of their children to their batterers, not because they're abusive to their kids, but because they're not in a position in the court's eyes to provide the children with the same stability, home life, economic resources as the father batterer is. And so in some visitation centers, like right now I'm in Flint, Michigan, and I just met with 5 visitation centers this morning, and one of the centers, 40% of the visiting parents are battered women. Another one, it's 25%. So the other 3 centers didn't know the percentage, but it was significant. There was a significant number of battered women using their visitation centers as the visiting parent. And so there's a large number of women who lose custody of their kids to the abuser and is now using the center. The question for us as visitation center workers is, what are we there for? What is our function or what is our purpose? The agreement I think we all have is that we're there to keep people safe. So the question is, who are we keeping safe from who? I'm trying to make this grammatically correct. It's probably who are we keeping safe from whom? And what are we keeping people safe from? So we're keeping people safe from physical abuse, sexual abuse, abduction, trauma, emotional harm, intimidation, coercion, those kinds of things that can happen as a part of a visit and a part of an exchange and the part of having contact between the adults. In cases of battering, and remember, all OVW money, all the money that comes through OVW and comes into visitation centers is particular for cases where there's a history of ongoing sexual abuse, stalking, or physical abuse, and child abuse connected to that. So OVW money is not really intended for cases where there isn't an issue of violence or past history of violence between the adults. So all the OVW cases, at least in many centers, OVW cases are only half their cases or a fourth of their cases, but still, there's a significant amount of their cases. So if you have OVW money, then you've got cases in which the adult is the vulnerable, one of the vulnerable people at least. So now the question for centers is, what does it mean for you to take the same stand with that adult as you take with that child? I'm not neutral when it comes to this child's safety. I'm here to make sure that to actively engage in practices that make that child safe from that father. And what does it mean to actively engage in making a woman who's being battered or stalked safe from her abuser who's using that center? It means you can't make the statement that we're neutral in the conflict between the parents because the conflict is wrapped up in and embedded in violence. And so it's created a real dilemma for visitation centers who have signed on to and are attached to the SVN guidelines, because SVN has been the mother and grandmother of this kind of movement to have safe places for these visitation centers to be and to exist. And so there's a real loyalty to that commitment to neutrality, and it's being questioned in the context of this new funding source. I would say it's caused conflict, it's caused some tension, but mostly it's caused a lot of really good debate and discussion, and it's beginning, I think, to start to come to some kind of resolution where it's not, it doesn't have to be a us against them kind of approach. It has to be a how do we embrace what SVN has been trying to protect all these years for both children and adult victims of abuse. And so there's a couple of proposals that people have come up with, that people are discussing and talking about, that I wanted to talk about in a little bit. But I just want to say that one of the key ones of those is to, this is the sin of sins, is to abandon in some ways the word neutral, to be neutral, and replace it with the term to be impartial and to be fair. Because there's a reason why people are protective of the word neutral, is that neutrality is something that is near and dear to the court system. And over 90% of cases that come into visitation centers are coming through the court system. And the court expects, if they're going to send someone to a visitation center, that the visitation center is not going to be advocating for one group of people or one group of people's interest over another group of people. So the court does not want to send people to a visitation center where that visitation center sees itself as actively advocates for a group of people. So let me give you an example of that. If I'm an advocate for a battered woman, that means that I am attached to her, her vision, her goals, her what she's trying to get. And if I am advocating for a battered woman, I'm advocating for her desires, her needs, her wants in the legal system or in the educational system or in a hospital setting, whatever institution she's kind of up against, I stand next to her and I'm a mouthpiece for her desires. And that's the term advocate means to speak on behalf of, to stand on the side of. And so if I'm advocating for a woman, I'm advocating for what she wants. And I've been trained as an advocate for battered women to say, what is it that you want out of this case? Not what I think she should have, but what does she want? And then to advocate, use my skills and my knowledge and my connections to advocate for what it is that she is trying to accomplish. I think we all agree that visitation centers should not have that relationship or that role with battered women. Even women who are using the visitation centers who are being battered, we should not take on that role of advocating for her, because it makes it so that we're not impartial. We can't be impartial when our function is to speak out for what she wants and what she desires, etc. I want to separate that, and this might be a little subtle, but I want to separate that notion of my obligation to her as her advocate to defend what she wants and what she's trying to get, to what it means for me to actively be engaged in protection of her and of children. That does not make me her advocate, but it makes me it makes it so I'm not neutral in the conflict between her and her partner, because that conflict is embedded in violence, and I'm standing on the side of nonviolence. So I'm positioning myself in a place to protect her from him and from his abuse and from his control and from his intimidation and from the kind of tactics that he might use to use his children to control her or to abuse her or to punish her, as well as any tactics that he might use to control his children or to hurt his children independent of his control of her. If I take that stand that I'm there against the violence, I'm against the violence that someone is committing towards someone, and typically that's going to be it's going to be, in the case of the adult, it's going to be the batterer who's going to be male. It's not, in when you're dealing with straight-out child abuse, it might be just as likely to be a woman who's abusing her child physically and sexually as it is the father. So if it's a child abuse case, then I'm not going to have such a gendered look at it because it's going to be a parent abusing their relationship and authority with a child, and that's going to be almost as likely to be a woman as it is a man, or actually, statistically, more mothers actually commit acts of violence against their children than fathers. But that's a whole big discussion about access to children and how much time they spend with children, et cetera, et cetera. But the point is that in these cases, if you're talking about the conflict between the adults, when there's domestic violence, which is all these OVW-related cases, this one adult is needing protection from another adult, so the position of the visitation center can't really be to say I'm neutral in that conflict. So I'm going to just stop here for a second, and I think I might just take a few questions or comments from people, but I wanted to start out with, I think, Laura, you're on the line and unmuted, I think, so I just want to ask you, Laura, to talk a little bit about, from a visitation center perspective, what this kind of paradigm shift has kind of forced you to have to do, or how it's forced you to have to think about this issue of neutrality differently, and what the issues are in a visitation center when we start to have this debate back and forth about are we neutral and what are we neutral about.
Well, I think in our experience at our center, having to look at this has caused us to just change a lot of the way that we do most of what we do in general. We sat down as a group and just started to look at, you know, the way that we were organized and how we were doing things, and asking ourselves, are we organized in a way that really does promote safety for both the battered women and their children? And we started to realize, you know, in the beginning, that some of the things that we were doing weren't necessarily doing that. And so we started to ask ourselves, you know, what are some of the things that we can do to start to do that? And like you were saying earlier, Ellen, about kind of separating from the personal advocacy to more of this institutional advocacy, we started to implement things like that in terms of, that's a good example, we would, our documentation process is very minimal compared to a lot of people, but even what we do document, we wanted to make sure that that information wasn't being used in a way that was more detrimental to the women that were being battered. So we started to monitor court cases to make sure that the information that was out there wasn't being used against women and their children. We also do lots of things where we follow up with practitioners if we recognize that they're failing to protect the women and children that use our center, which is something that we never did before. We most certainly, you know, refer women to advocacy services here. We're kind of lucky in the sense that we're located right in our domestic violence organization. But it's definitely been a big process for us. And I know, you know, just out in the field and talking with other people and what they're doing, that this word neutrality is really important to a lot of people. And they feel that by letting go of it, you're letting go of being fair in a sense.
Mm-hmm. And so the suggestion here is to replace that word with the word impartial, meaning that, because the word neutral in almost any definition that you look at, it means to not take sides. It means to not be aligned with one side over the other, to not favor either side in a dispute or a contest, meaning to belong to neither side or contrast. You can see I'm reading these definitions now. Belonging to neither kind, not one thing or the other, a nation not aligned with either side in a war, one who takes no side in a controversy, not expressing an opinion or taking actions that support either side in a disagreement. These are not things that we are when we talk about that 11-year-old girl and the father. We are aligned with her to protect her from his violence, and at the same time, we want to be impartial and fair towards him. We don't want to say that every father who comes into a center that we are going to somehow make some kind of big assumptions about him or treat disrespectfully or unfairly, but we also don't want to say that we're going to act like nothing's happened. We're there because of his or her violence. If it's the mother who's being violent, we're there because of their violence, their coercion, their intimidation, and we're there to protect someone, a child, from that. And in the case of adults, we're there to protect one adult from another. And sometimes that would be to protect a man from a woman. It's going to be rare, but that is going to be there sometimes, where the woman is the person that has the history of violence towards the other. And we could go into this long thing, but the battering by women of men is rare for a lot of reasons. Unfortunately, it's not because us women are spiritually more developed. It's a lot because we don't have the wherewithal to batter as much as men do. It's not a tactic that is as readily available to us because of our strength differentiation, our socialization difference, the way people respond to our violence is different. So there's a lot of reasons why women are far less likely to batter as men. But it's not because we're biologically superior, I can just say that. I assure you all of that, we're not. So, but you're not going to find a whole lot of battered men using our visitation centers. You will find men who've been hit by women, but battering, which is the ongoing use of violence, coercion, intimidation in a pattern formed by one partner against another, is not a tactic that many women are able to effectively use in relationships and therefore don't. Now, if it came down to manipulation or something like that, we could be a lot more equal. But battering is not something that most women do. So most of the victims, adult victims of ongoing abuse, we're not saying victims of an incident of abuse, because it has to be victims of some kind of ongoing abuse that need protection in the future, where there's a notion of that this person is at risk of future and continued violence. So that's why we keep referring to battering as opposed to just an act of domestic violence. So we're not going to have a whole lot of women. It's going to be mostly men who are doing the battering and the protection of women from those men. So OVW throws into this thing of here's some money, but it's got to be for those cases. And it's got to be to figure out what to do with those cases differently. And so they started to say things like, well, look at all your policies, look at all your rules. Just like Laura was saying, it's that all of a sudden we had to look at this policy about who's going to come first, who's going to come and sit and wait while the other person comes and brings the kids. So we have this idea that the non-custodial parent is going to come first and sit and wait, with the idea that non-custodial parent is typically the dangerous one. And then once they're sitting in the visitation center for 15 minutes, the other parent can come assuring all of us that she didn't get hassled outside the building or he didn't get hassled outside the building and the children didn't. But what happens when the person who's coming to sit there and wait first is in fact the victim? What happens when it's the victim of battering that's visiting her children? And he then has the ability to hassle her outside that building, because now we've set up a protection, not based on who needs protection from who, but simply this category of custodial and non-custodial parent. So one of the things that this whole thing did is it made us have to look at, can we really just make this division custodial parent is the one that needs protection from the non-custodial parent, when 40% In the shelter that I met with this morning, 40% of the non-custodial parents are battered women. So sometimes you'll see that when you have a policy that divides things by custodial and non-custodial, you're not protecting adult victims from the abuser. And that policy of having the non-custodial parent come first should be written that the non-custodial parent or the... No, it should be written that the custodial parent comes after the non-custodial parent, and it should say the custodial parent or parent at risk. Because if whenever you're trying to protect someone, which has been typically the custodial parent, if you add to that or parent at risk, have to add that to the non-custodial parent. But you have to add in there the parent at risk, so that sometimes you're not talking custodian, non-custodial. Positions are reversed, and therefore you want to protect the non-custodial parent. And so whenever the non-custodial parent is being battered, do your policies protect them? Or do they assume always that the non-custodial parent is the likely victim? So this required everyone to start, as Laura said, to start running through their policies and saying, what have we done here? Are we really protecting adult victims as well as child victims? Are we making some assumptions here that are perhaps wrong? And that has led to a lot of consternation, a lot of challenging of things, but a recognition also of the degree to which all of this discussion of neutrality has led people to think that we need to treat men and women in these centers the same. And when you treat people who are not the same the same, in a human service agency like this where there's a lot of violence, you almost always advantage the abuser over the victim. So when you start having this thing of, we have to treat the men just like the women in order to be fair, in order to be neutral, when one is a victim and one is an offender, then you abdicate your role, of your protection role. And so you can be impartial and still engage in protective activity. But to be neutral gets translated, whether it should or shouldn't, it almost invariably gets translated into treating people the same, and to not engage in who's an abuser and who isn't, and then treat them differently. So I'm going to stop here and let people make some comments or ask questions or something, and then I want to go on to give some very, very concrete examples of how this plays out in the visitation center.
Okay, at this time, if you would like to ask a question or have a comment, please press the number 1 on your touch-tone phone now. All questions will be answered in the order they are received. Pressing the number 1 on your phone twice will remove you from the question queue, so please be careful in only pressing the number 1 one time. Thank you. Our first question today comes from Patricia Maynard. Go ahead, Patricia.
Hi. You might have muted yourself, Patricia. Because we're not hearing you. Operator, can you tell if Patricia's muted?
Patricia, it's your turn to talk. If your phone is muted, please unmute your phone. Okay. We'll go to the next person, which will be Heather Wilson.
What?
Go ahead, Heather.
I don't have a question.
Okay, thank you.
Heck no.
And the next person we have is Beth Chaplin. Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, Ellen. It's Beth in Chicago. How are you?
Hi, good.
Because it's not so much of a question as it is a statement, I really like your suggestion of changing the language, because as you know, here in Chicago, we have struggled a little bit around the use of the word neutrality, and what our visitation centers kind of came up with is that while we try to be neutral, we are never neutral to the violence, and that was kind of the way that it was framed here, but... yeah, so I really like, I'm going to definitely take that and run with it. And then I also wanted to comment on what you mentioned about trying to be fair with the batterer, or, well, as you said, the father, because generally, as you stated, the abuser is the father. And that's one thing that our centers found key, is that while, you know, they're dealing with people that have done some pretty horrific things, and have really been abusive and terrible and you know, to their partners and often to their children as well, that if you demonize the abuser when they walk through the door, that kind of sets a precedent. And if you demonize him as he comes through the door, then perhaps you're going to see some of that behavior reflected back, or some of that attitude reflected back. So trying to remain impartial while not being impartial to any violence or continued abuse or tactics of abuse, I just think that that is such an important message, and just really like the way that you're framing it.
Yeah, and you know, that's one of the things that that in all areas when you deal with people who have a big history of violence, that the more hostile you treat them, the more you agitate their propensity towards violence. The more respectful you treat them, the more you reduce the likelihood of violence. So there's a lot of ways that batterers in visitation centers get treated in ways that demonize them or that objectify them or actually really make them uncomfortable. And, you know, I don't want to oversimplify this, but the more uncomfortable an abuser is, the more likely they're going to be abusive. And so how is it that you, the other word I want to throw in there is respectful. So if you toss the word neutral and replace it with being impartial, and we'll do that for purposes of relating to the court, and then in treatment of people, always strive for fairness and respectfulness, you're doing a big safety thing there because, you know, I know from working with batterers for many years in the work that I did, that the more, when I did my groups with men, the more respectful I was to them, the more I reached out to their humanity, not their negative side, but their positive side, the more likely I was to engage with them in a way that reduced their hostility and opened them up to the possibility not only of change, but of being nice to me. And, I always say that the safest people in the domestic violence field, the safest work is to work with batterers directly. Because when you're doing work that's helpful to them, they're least likely to go after you. The people who most often get harmed or hurt physically by an abuser are divorce attorneys, people who help their partners leave them and separate from them. So that's the divorce attorneys and judges, et cetera, like that. They're the ones that get shot. And advocates oftentimes get attacked by abusers. But it's very, very rare that people who work directly with batterers get attacked by them because they see that work is there to somewhat help them. So the same thing in visitation centers. The more respectful and engaging you are with the abuser, the more you're going to reduce the likelihood of any kind of attack of you, even though I'm not saying it completely eliminates it, but it brings the level and propensity for violence down. So I want to throw two words in there. Besides the to be impartial, and the other two words would be to be fair and to be respectful. And those things, being fair and being respectful, and then in relationship to documentation and reports to the court, to write objective and impartial, have an impartial relationship with all members of the family and an objective report, that satisfies the court's need for an unbiased center to send people to, and a center that they can send people to and trust that the information they're getting is not advocating for a particular group of people over another group of people.
Hi. My question, you mentioned having the forms or our forms, our intakes, read the non-custodial or non-residential parent or parent at risk.
Uh-huh.
And I'm wondering how, because I'm sure most programs would do risk assessments, and they only help determine that, who that is, but how do you explain that to a batterer that, you know, even though I know that you're the custodial parent, you know, we've determined that, you know, the other parent is really the one at risk here, and I guess, and I'm wondering too how that might look to the courts if they've, although they, I'm sure they, I mean, they don't have a say in what our policies are, but I guess I'm just wondering how would you explain that or word that, and could that be a source of agitation?
Definitely, that would be a source of agitation. because, you know, what I would not do is I wouldn't do the opposite of, say, offending parent, because mm-hmm. if you say that this is a parent at risk, you're basically making some kind of an assessment that you think that this person might, for some reason, be unsafe.
Exactly.
And, you don't have to defend that to the hilt. What you do have to defend is when you say someone is an offender.
Right.
And so I wouldn't go the other route and say, okay, then let's label the other parent as the offending parent. So if you say this person is at risk, I'm a big believer that when people come into the center, and some people use the term intake for that process and some people use the word orientation, but if someone is coming into your center and you're doing an orientation with them, it's your first meeting with them, right? It's the way you establish your relationship with them. And one of the things that you want to do, it's kind of like if I was, you know, if I was running a, what do you call it, a shop where you fix cars, and you bring your car into me, the first thing I'm going to do is say, well, what do you think's wrong with it? And you're going to say, well, it's leaking oil, and it's doing this, and it's doing that. I shouldn't have used this analogy because I know nothing about cars. But anyway, so then I'm going to look under the hood. There is a hood, right? And I'm going to start kind of messing around. I'm going to do a little analysis of what's wrong with your car. And because that's what I do, I fix cars. Mm-hmm. And the strange things about visitation centers is visitation centers provide safety, but they've been reluctant to determine who needs it.
Right.
And so if that's what you do, if you provide safety, then the first thing you need to do is to say, who needs it and for what reason? And what kind of safety do they need? And I want to make a couple of statements about this. This is the whole problem. This is going to be, like, if you go around the country and you look at what's happening in visitation centers all over, there's a gigantic lack of engagement with families on a substantial level that you would think a human service agency that has this kind of intense contact with families, that they'd be more engaged with them. And the reason that you see kind of a standoffish, non-engagement posture in visitation centers with family members is because of this notion of neutrality. Mm. And it's almost like the court, what's going on in that court system has taken over the possibilities of what we could be to families, because every single thing we do gets measured up against how is this going to get used in court. How is this going to be used against her or against him? If I do this, then he's going to use that and say this. If I do this. So the whole relationship you have to that family gets cloaked in this court battle that's going on here over here. Now, one of the important things, I think, for visitation centers to think about is, are you a visitation center that's the eyes and ears of the court? If that's what you want to be, that's a legitimate thing to be. But visitation centers shouldn't be precluded from wanting to be more than that. In other words, for me, you know, I'm 58 years old. If I'm going to work in a visitation center for the next 7 or 8 years, and I think this is a major little piece of my life, and I want to be a part of something bigger than simply making sure no one gets hit for 2 hours. I want to be a part of trying to figure out how in our community, when people separate, when there's been a history of violence, the community is positioned to help those families make it through this 2-year period with people not getting hurt, not getting killed, not getting snatched, not getting absconded with, not getting messed with, not being traumatized. And to do that, we have to recognize the layers of safety that surround these victims. And that first layer is, yes, what happens in those 2 hours that we're there. But the next layer is for this whole period of time when in battering relationships, when oftentimes there's a separation for whatever reason, but oftentimes the woman who's being battered steps out of that relationship, all the danger kind of things tend to escalate with some abusers. And as that period of time occurs for the next 2 months to 2 years, of escalation, visitation centers are planted right in that time. That's when they're actively working with these families. So we have to think about this, that you're there to provide safety during that 2-hour visit, but you're doing that within a 2-year period where everything is going a little bit haywire in terms of the whatever kind of stability there's been in that family. It's not there now, and that lack of stability, that divorce case that's going on, that decision about who the kids are going to be with, her decision to leave him and to not go back to him, all those things create within the batterer a much more dangerous period of time. And therefore, you've got this two-year period where you're trying to get him through this two-year period doing the least amount of harm that's possible. He's going to do some harm, I guarantee you. There's very few batterers can make it through this period of time without harming people. But your job, or I think our job collectively with the courts and the police and batterers programs and visitation centers and shelters, all of us together, our goal should be to get him through that period of time doing the least amount of damage to his children and his partner as possible. And then our other goal should be to be as protective as possible to get that victim through that period with the least amount of emotional, physical, and sexual harm done to them. And then our goal should be to get the kids through that period with the least amount of trauma and physical and sexual harm. If that's our goal with all three, then we have to be engaged in a much more active way than we are now engaged in visitation centers. Visitation centers have an incredible opportunity to work with these families, and those opportunities are oftentimes constrained by this notion that we have to be neutral in the conflict that's going on between the man and the woman. And I'm suggesting that we don't have to be neutral at all about that. What we have to be is fair, and we have to give the court, it's the court's job to decide who custody. And the court wants us to tell them, I need to make the safest decision possible. Do you know anything about safety of these children or that woman that I should know as I'm making this decision? And we should be informing the court objectively what we know about the safety of these children and adult victims, in so that when the court makes that decision, those safety factors are visible to them. I also want to suggest that our current position on neutrality is causing us to write reports to the court that are in fact not very informative and don't make visible for the court the kind of danger that actually exists. And so I want to give an example of that, and now I know I'm not answering your question because I'm going back and thinking about it, but let me give my example and come back to you to be more concrete about your question. There's a guy named Bill who I went to a visitation center with several other people, and we were going to look at 5 case files from that visitation center, and then we were going to meet with everybody who knew something about that case, the center, the shelter, the judge, and we were going to just analyze, kind of like a death review, only nobody died. But we were looking at old cases, and we were going to analyze what happened in that case, and did everybody do the safest thing possible for that family. And in this case, this guy's name was Bill. And Bill had been arrested for, his wife and him had split up. He was very, very obsessed with his children, what school they went to, what they wore to school, what time they came home from school, what church they went to, what books they read, what TV shows they watched. He was very, very, very obsessed with every idea that the children were exposed to, everything that they did. When she decided to leave him, after the abuse in their relationship started to move into more sexual abuse, she decided to leave him. And he came to pick up the kids one day for a visit and then locked himself in the house and the kids, called her up, said he was going to kill the kids, kill himself. The police showed up, and it was a long, long standoff for like hours and hours and hours, and he finally decided not to do it. But it was one of the deputies at the scene was saying that he was convinced that they were going to be pulling bodies out of that house, and he just said it was just like something that turned on this guy, and he decided not to do it, but he could have just as easily gone the other way. So he ends up going to jail. He pleads guilty to some crime. I can't remember what he pled guilty to. He ended up in a treatment program, an alcohol treatment program for 30 days, and then an ongoing aftercare treatment program, and then into counseling, individual counseling he got, not a batterers group. And then he got supervised visitations of his kids after he got out of treatment. And in this little review that we were doing, we were looking at his case file. And his case file, I mean, I don't want to laugh at it, but it was kind of funny because it had three basic things in it that were going to the court. One was a letter from the CD center that he had gone to saying Bill has successfully completed his CD program and he is now going to AA. And they didn't do any evaluation of him. They just said he came, he's completed it, and now he's going to AA. Then from the counseling agency, it said, Bill has taken responsibility now for a lot of his anger, and he's ready to reconcile with his wife. And this it was supposed to be a batterer's program, and it was offering to do mediation between him and his wife now, and saying that they thought that he was really ready to approach his wife and to start over. It did say, the fact that his wife didn't want to ever see him again, it didn't mention that, but it kind of did this little funny thing. And then the third thing in the file was Bill had visited his kids 12 times at the center, and it was 12 reports. And the reports were that Bill came in, that the kids came in, they hugged, they played Monopoly, Billy fell at one point, scraped his knee, little Billy, and then Bill, the father, was appropriate in how he took care of Billy. Jennifer wanted to know if he would be coming to the school play. He said no, he couldn't come to the school play, and but told her he'd be very interested in hearing about the play when it was over. And there's 12 reports like this. They play Monopoly, they play Tiddlywinks, they play this, they play that. And at the end of these 12 reports, after we had read these and read these two reports, we said to the woman who knew the case the best at the visitation center, do you think that the court getting this information was useful to the court in its deliberations about whether or not Bill is a safe person to be with his children? And she said, oh, no. She says, Bill gives me the creeps. I'm scared to death of him. In fact, I think he's going to do something weird. And then we said, but that's not what's in these papers. In these papers, Bill's looking pretty good. You know, at least he plays Monopoly well. And we asked why this is what's in the thing. And she said, because we can only report objective things. And we said, what does that mean? What's objective mean? Well, we can only report what happened when he was here. So he came in, and this is what happened. He played with the kids. He played well. He went home. They went home. And so we have 12 of those reports. And so we started to say, what does this mean? Like, why are you afraid of him? You're saying you're afraid of him. And she said, well, he comes early a lot of times, and he tries to talk to me, and he's always trying to act like we're friends or something. And then he wants me to read this and read that, and he keeps talking about, like, he's asking me all these questions about the kids. How are the kids doing in school, and what grades are they getting, and what books are they reading, and what this, but in a way that makes me really uncomfortable, even though I can't say why it makes me uncomfortable. And then what else? She said, well, he keeps getting people to call me and tell me that he's doing good. Like, I've gotten 3 phone calls from that chemical dependency program, and I've gotten 2 phone calls from that counselor. And she starts listing all these little things, and she puts them all together, and she says that I feel like he's just pushing to get her back or get the kids back, and if he doesn't get that, I have no idea why anything would be different than what happened before, only this time he might go through with it. There's nothing that makes me think that he isn't totally obsessed with his kids, and if he were to lose them, and in fact, when I talked to her, kind of off the record, she is stringing him along because she's too scared to tell him she's not coming back. She feels like if she says I'm not coming back, that will flip him over and that, you know, he'll do something and she's not sure what. And so this is all to say none of this is in this report because she kept saying we have to be neutral in the conflict between the parents and objective just about what we saw. And this rule, then, of being neutral, we started to look at other files and asking other people what you're putting, and is there a difference between what you think and what you put in these files? And many people said yes, that they're not allowed to put in opinions. Right, okay, you're not allowed to put in opinions. But what are you putting in? And so we started to say, why are you putting in what you're putting in? Why wouldn't you, for example, in Bill's case, say that Bill the reason Bill came here is because he abducted the kids, locked himself in the house with them, threatened to kill himself, threatened to kill the children, and having him visit in an unsupervised setting was determined by the court to not be safe. Why don't you report that he has come and visited his kids, and he has not tried to abduct them from the center? And so the center, visiting at the center, to date has been a safe thing. Why the monopoly? Why how he played at the game? Why how he dealt with the knee injury? Why are those things in there when they're not and have nothing to do with your concern about his safety? Now, let's say that the reason, okay, so in Bill's case then, what other things could you have said to the court? How could you have reported this and been impartial and fair, but still told the court you think it's, you still don't trust, you've got this instinct that tells you something's not right. What could you objectively report? You could report that he seems to be calling you, making appointments with you that are unnecessary, talking about the kids with information, you know, blah, blah, blah. You could do some of this. We started saying, what could this center be doing? So we then talked to the judges and said, what do you want? And the judges said, I'm trying to make a decision. Is this guy safe or not? I want to know if he's safe or not. I want to know that kind of information. And so what we started finding was that this obsession with being neutral also became an obsession with not saying anything to the courts. And when we started to look at different centers and having them look at particular cases that they had a sense was dangerous and then looked at their reports to the court, they didn't match up. The danger that they sensed and that they had some objective kind of reasons for sensing it, that wasn't in there. And what was in there was a whole bunch of information that lulled the court into thinking this guy was probably safe. So all of that led us to the conclusion that if you really want to be impartial and fair and protective, then the reports to the court should be centered on what makes you think or not think. What objective facts do you have or information do you have that makes you think there's a safety issue here? And that's what you should be reporting to the courts on. Not that they played well together, not that they did this, not that they did that. Unless the reason the father is visiting is because the mother is making a claim that he can't be with those kids alone because he doesn't know how to feed them, he doesn't know how to change a diaper, he doesn't know how to take care of the children, then how he takes care of the children in that visit is pertinent to the court because it's the reason for the visit. So we started coming to the conclusion and consulting with several attorneys about this, and the attorneys were pretty much in agreement that what we should be reporting to the court is information pertinent to the reason the court sent them there in the first place, which, of course, raised a lot of questions about the lack of the responsibility of the court to give good reasons for sending them there. The courts were just sending people and not telling the visitation centers why, not telling them what the safety features were to even look for. Oftentimes, the visitation centers didn't even know which court was sending them there. So it also led to a whole discussion about how can visitation centers have a better connection to the court and the responsibility of the court. If you're going to use this center, you have to tell us why people are coming here, and you have to alert us to the safety issues that you're trying to get us to provide protection for. The courts have a responsibility to community services that they use this way, and many courts were not living up to that responsibility. And so it was a one-way street. The visitation centers were feeling responsible to the court, but the court wasn't reciprocating with a responsible, in what I would call a responsible referral. Now, how that answers your question, I would say it doesn't. And the question was so long ago that, I remember you said that you can't really try to say that he's the offender. When you're doing those intakes, you do have to ask people the purpose of that intake or orientation. One of the purposes is to establish ongoing relationship that you're going to be able to work with this family. But a really big function of that initial meeting with them is to figure out who needs what kind of protection. So if you ask both the man and the woman, do you think your children will be safe here? Do you have any safety concerns for them? What do you think could happen? talking about. Follow you here. Follow you home. Use this as an opportunity to do something to you. Anything like that that we should be aware of that you want us to pay attention to. And then when you have that discussion with them, you're going to make the determination that an adult has talked to you in a convincing way that they need protective measures by the center, and that would designate them as a parent at risk. It could be both parents, it could be either parent, but you'll be able to then designate all battered women as parents at risk. Any other questions that people have?
At this time, we show no additional questions.
Okay. Now, can you tell me what time it is? I'm in an office where there's no clock.
Ellen, we have about 12 minutes left.
Okay. Can you tell me when we have 6 left?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Okay. So, almost everybody on the line has the bulk of people coming into your centers are coming in through the court, and you have a responsibility to the court to provide to them objective information. What the court needs from you is they need to know that the information they're getting from you is, all day long people stand in front of judges and lie to them. And people come into court, and they've got attorneys, and the attorneys spin cases. So especially in divorce cases or anything, the attorneys are going to spin. I didn't say that lawyers lie to them. I said people lie to them. I just want to make that clear here. But attorneys spin for their client a tale that says, my client is a victim of this, and my client is a victim of that, and my client needs this, and my client that. And that's what attorneys do. They present a case to the court that says that the court should rule in their client's behalf. And they put in that information and those facts that favor their client. And they talk about that information and those facts in ways that make the court lean towards the desired outcome that their client has. That is what the court does not want you to do. They don't need more of those people talking to them. They want someone who isn't going to do that, who is not going to spin facts or create facts towards one person over the other. And this is the relationship the court does not want you to have to a person using your center, a relationship where you're advocating for that person's interest over the other person's. And this is what SVN's guidelines are trying to prevent, that visitation centers would advocate for, actively take the position of one parent over the other in this court case. Now, let us try to separate that then from that relationship of advocacy and that relationship of being a spokesperson for. And if I tell a woman that I'm going to advocate for her, I'm establishing a relationship with her where I'm going to speak on her behalf, and I'm going to say to her, what do you want, and I'm going to go for that. And if I'm her lawyer or I'm her advocate, I'm trying to put information out that will get that person what they need and want. That is never the role of a visitation center to do that. And that is where the stance of neutrality, that's what it's tried to prevent, is visitation centers from establishing those kind of relationships with people who use the centers. And we are probably all in agreement that, or most of us are in agreement, visitation centers should not do that. So that does, and what that has inadvertently done then is made us take this neutral stance in the conflict between the parents and get mushy and unclear and a lack of engagement then in the protection of adult victims. So that's why people are saying, let us move to a position of engagement, not neutral, where we do not take a stand or act, but of impartial engagement. Meaning, I don't have a relationship with this person where I'm going for what they want or need or desire in their court case. I'm engaged in an active way of trying to prevent someone from getting hurt. So I am engaged, and I'm standing on the side of protection and nonviolence over violence and coercion and intimidation. So we're separating, as people want to try to do, the person from the behavior. The behavior is the violence. So I'm actively participating in things that will prevent this abuser from being able to use coercion, intimidation, and violence. So this engaged stance then allows visitation centers much more latitude in how they act towards and behave towards adult partners. Because I am there, clearly there, if a man has been beating up his wife and she's using the visitation center because it's unsafe for her to have him come over to her house and pick up the kids, it's unsafe for her to go over to his house and drop off the kids, then I am clearly there to protect her from his violence. And so if I can get rid of this notion that I'm neutral in whatever this word conflict is between them, and instead say that I do not have an advocacy role to take a stand of her case over his, that's what we want to avoid and be quite clear on. And that's what we want to be clear on with the men and the women when they come in there. We are not going to be your advocates in your court case against each other. We are going to do everything we can to keep everybody safe, and we are going to protect those people who are vulnerable to violence from those people who are using the violence. And so in that sense, we can be more engaged. And so I want to give a couple little examples of, I just want to say that if you look at how it is that people have interpreted then this what I consider to be a non-engagement practice, where we try to treat people the same and we try to make everybody look like everything's the same, then we end up with this incredible opportunity to work with people in visitation centers towards reducing the violence, and we let those opportunities go because we're trying to be neutral. There's many, many opportunities in visitation centers if we are properly trained, and I don't think this takes a therapy license or, it doesn't take years and years of training. It takes some training for people to be comfortable with knowing how to help men when they have a tendency to want to start to be harmful, to stop and think and reflect and really make a decision, is this what I want to do? And you can see many times in the visitation center that those tendencies coming out in the men when they're visiting, the things that the kids say or do and the way that they want to then start talking about their mother, that gives you an opportunity to talk to him about what he really wants to do. Those skills of doing that are not, I think, I've been in many, many visitation centers, and the center workers are skilled. They're not the only thing they can do isn't just write down stuff on a piece of paper and hand it in. There's a lot of very skilled people working in these centers. And I think what we have to do is just hone in on the kind of skills that you need to engage with families in ways that helps them through this period of time. It helps them be more reflective about the kinds of things that they're doing. And we want to do two things. We want to reduce the opportunity for the abuser to abuse, which we do by keeping them away from the woman, by having rules about what things you can and can't do in the center, by preventing people from bringing in certain kinds of things that could be, that could lead to, like, trauma, etc. We have physical ways of reducing the opportunity for the abuser, but we also want to reduce the inclination of the abuser to continue to abuse. Because for most of us, abusers only use visitation centers for a few months. And when those few months are over and they now have unsupervised visits, to what extent has their contact with us helped shift them beyond simply that we created an environment in which they couldn't abuse? We want to create an environment in which they don't want to abuse anymore. So we want to give equal kind of effort towards reducing the inclination to abuse as we do the opportunity to abuse. I think visitation centers are very good at reducing and almost eliminating the opportunity to abuse, but we're not as good at reducing the inclination to abuse. And we aren't because we have this kind of non-engagement policy. And I don't have time to go into all that now, but we could do that probably at another time. But what I want to kind of leave with people is this idea that in the name of neutrality, we have actually participated in kind of a non-engagement practice that probably I just put it this way, that there are many, many, many opportunities. Visitation centers know families more than anybody else in the system. There isn't anybody who sees them as often, who sees them interacting with their children, who has the opportunities to talk to both the men, the women, and the children. Nobody in the system, except therapists who have some whole families that they're working with. But by and large, visitation centers have the key opportunity to work with every member of the family in this post-separation reorganization of that family. These people, you know, 90-some percent of them are going to have ongoing relationships with each other for the next 20 years or more. There is no one who's better positioned than visitation centers to impact what that next 20 years is going to look like, to give, to be the community agency that has an impact on how this they carry on from now on. And so visitation centers need to re-examine how the commitment to neutrality, which we want to keep all the good parts of it, has really led to a disengaged practice, one that misses many, many opportunities to help reduce the inclination of abusers to abuse, to help children be able to articulate and be in relationships with their parents the way that's good for them, and to help victims of ongoing abuse figure out how to co-parent with someone who they've had this relationship of violence and abuse and intimidation with, and at the same time to be able to be safe and to hold their own in that relationship. And those are three very tricky things to do, but there's no one in a better place to do it than visitation centers. And I'm not saying that every visitation center has to have that as their goal, but many probably want to and could if they could re-examine this notion of what it means to be neutral. And the other reason to re-examine this notion of what it means to be neutral is that in the name of neutrality, we are actually, when you treat two people who are very different the same, and one is a victim and one is an offender, that typically favors and acts in a biased way towards the offender.
Maybe I could say, Beth, then, when Judge Wong, and who else will be on?
Judge Bowles, Jerry Bowles.
Okay, both of them, I think people in the audience, if you're thinking, oh, she's nuts about this neutrality and partiality thing, those are the two to ask about that. Like, is it true that the judges, that we don't have to use this word neutral, that we could do impartial and fair? And what does that mean? What's the difference between the two? And some of the things I'm saying, be sure that people raise those questions. If you have questions about, is this really acceptable to the court, then that's the place to raise that and see if they're agreeing with what I'm saying. If they aren't, then we just forget everything I said.
Well.